Well, welcome to this workshop. Do you ever miss being a child? Well, for 45 minutes, we get to return to the fascinating world of middle scholars. And I do have handouts, but I'm going to give it to you at the end because it's just my slides reproduced. And so now you can look at the real ones and get involved in the discussion. I'm Angela. I'm an elementary school teacher in northern Utah. So it's the 9 to 11-year-olds who live in my classroom. And so if you ever feel like I'm talking to you like children, I was just in the classroom 2 days ago. And I'll try to remember you're adults. But my students actually contributed to this workshop. I included them as well as quite a few other middle scholars in a survey about their favorite books and authors and story genres. So yeah, I'm happy to show you some of their input. And I've also learned a lot from their moms and dads, because of course they get to spend a lot more time with them than I do. Just last Friday I had about a 2-hour conversation with a mom of 12 children and some foster and adopted children, and they all love to read, and so I learned a lot from her. And this book, On Becoming Preteen Wise, I referenced it a lot through my school teaching years and found it very helpful. It's an easy read and comprehensive on a very little spoken of age group. And I've also learned a lot from Jenny Bowman, How to Write a Middle Grade Novel, one of the very few articles I found in my research that was helpful. And I'm also counting on you and your input, because I'm sure many of you have worked with middle scholars. Maybe you teach them, maybe they're your children. Maybe you're a middle scholar yourself, and if you are, you can tell us whether we're dissecting you correctly, and you can keep us on track. So let's start out by exploring what kind of a creature a middle scholar is. I have some ideas, but as you can see from my header, he's changing. He's in transit. From what to what? From what? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anything a little more specific? Or whatever came to your mind first?
Maybe pre-adolescence to adolescence.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I want to hear your ideas before I put all mine up there.
Beginning of conscience.
Yes. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Their conscience is a lot farther along than it used to be.
Learning to think more logically.
Yes, that's a good one. Mm-hmm.
Dependence to independence.
Mm-hmm.
From innocence to accountability.
Yes, that too. That's starting to grow.
From being completely uninhibited to being a little more cautious.
Yes, that's always a little sad, isn't it?
Yeah.
In some ways. Good. I like this. So here's what I have. He's going from a world of family and friends, fairly small, fairly narrow, to a broader one, which means he's going from imagination to reason as well. And that means that imaginative play isn't quite as important to him anymore. And so he's becoming thirstier for knowledge and hungrier for adventure, something bigger than him. Another thing I found, influence is beginning to make a bigger impression on him than command. He's beginning to care a little more what his peers think than what his mom and dad thinks. And making a good impression and becoming accepted are beginning to be really important, a major driving force in his life. Also, knowing the reasons behind commands is becoming more important too to him. He's becoming more responsible. He can be more responsible than what we even expect sometimes. He can control himself better. And now, granted, this flops back and forth. You think that, oh, yeah, really becoming mature here, and then flips right back to being a 6-year-old again. he often returns to wanting everything done for him, but he is still beginning to become better at taking ownership of his behavior. Next year's first graders spent a week in my classroom recently, and I told my regular students that this was a sign that they were definitely getting to be on the grown-up edge of things. And they should not ask me questions unless they were just hopelessly stuck because I was going to be super busy. Well, they went on this no questions campaign. At the end of the day, they'd compare notes, and whoever had asked Miss Angela one or two questions, they were pretty smart. And whoever had asked me none was a hero. And one of my second grade girls said, whoever asked negative 20 should become the next queen. Well, we didn't crown anybody, but I was surprised because 90% of the time they didn't need me at all. So that shows, of course, that they're a lot more capable than I had been counting on them for. I think they even surprised themselves. Another one, he's developing a very strong sense of fairness. That sounds familiar probably. You know, but Mom, Jackson turned cartwheels on the kitchen counter yesterday and you didn't stop him. And you always let her do stuff, but you get after me for the same thing. So yes, justice and fairness are really important. And the last one, he's learning to process things by moral standards. Mr. Ezzo, in the book On Becoming Preteen Wise, tells the story of Nate and the cake. Nate's mom decorated this cake for their guests that evening, and as she prepared to leave for town, she told her son, don't touch the cake. Well, an hour or so later, Nate went to the kitchen for a drink, and there sat the cake in a brilliant patch of sunshine that had moved, and the icing looked kind of languid, and it was getting saggier even as he watched. But don't touch the cake. But since Nate was the grand age of 10, he knew there was a higher moral principle overshadowing that command, don't touch. It was, keep the cake beautiful for our guests. So he slid the cake over to a shady patch of counter. His profound wisdom delighted his mom, of course, when she came home because it saved her day. But that's your middle scholar. He's starting to realize the overarching higher standards and being able to make better and wiser judgments. Has this made you think of any more that you'd like to add? Okay, so how can we use this knowledge of middle scholars to help us? Well, do you remember what that very first point was on the list? He's thirsty for and hungry for adventure, yes. Since middle scholars are thirsty for knowledge and hungry for adventure, most of them just read voraciously. I don't know if you know some like this. But statistically, this age group has the largest readership of any other age group. Some writers call it the golden age of reading. And I wonder if this is one reason why this age group isn't mentioned as often as young children, writing for young children, or writing for teens, or, you know, writing for adults. Because many of them will read just anything, good quality or not. So I guess that means we don't have to worry about honing skills and reaching them as much. Well, the secret is, if you capture the hearts of this age group by writing to their heartbeat, they will be the largest group of loyal and loving readership that any author could have. Because once you've got their hearts, you can teach them almost anything. Whoops. So, based on that premise, it's smart to write something, if you're writing a book, that has potential for a series. Because in that survey I did of middle scholars and their favorite books, what percent of their favorite books do you think were part of a series?
Greater than 80.
Oh. Yes, greater than 80. Any other guesses? It was 98%. Yeah. And their moms told me that the books they beg for the most are sequels to ones they've read already. So not only is this great potential for your writing career, but publishers like it too, because they have a chance to get more than one book from an author who their readership is just begging for more books from them, and they're dedicated to buying them or badgering their moms and dads to buy them for them. This group is very good at taking a story person into their hearts. They want to be with him more and more, especially if they've really captured him or her. So thinking of series, what are some series, what are some series you have read as a middle scholar, if you can think back that long ago, that you really, really liked? And then we're going to look at them and see if we can decide what those authors did to capture this age group's hearts.
Amy's Walker.
Yes. Good.
Lucy Montgomery.
Mm-hmm.
Lost Landscape.
Okay, I don't think I know that one.
You should.
Yeah, I should.
Richard Halliburton's
stories. Yes.
Eleanor Estes.
Oh, yes. I've read hers. Uh-huh.
Jen Kilgard, The Boy's Dolls.
Yes. Oh, yes. I have one student that's about all he'll read. Just loves these kinds. And then, as you saw, sneak preview. These are some of the ones I thought of and some of the ones I hear my students talking about. Grandma's Attic. Jennings. Now, that's one you might not recognize. It's a British author. And he has like 10, 12 books about a boy in an English boarding school. Very fascinating. Of course, The Boxcar Children in the Little House. Here's some more I thought of. Yvonne, that's 6 books, I think, in a series of a boy in Soviet Russia. Henry Reed, All of a Kind Family, and of course the Thornton Burgess books. So let's scrutinize some of these series characteristics that have captured middle scholars' hearts. And this is why we wanted to first look at what kind of a creature a middle scholar is. Because how can we view the world the way he does unless we understand him? So let's see how these authors viewed the world through middle scholars' eyes. And so I have a little excerpt here from Jennings. Yes. I'm a big prune hunter searching the African jungles for a rare specimen known as the lesser shriveled prune, Jennings announced in mocked gravity as he polished the lens on his tie. This is the lens of a telescope. The ripple of amusement among his friends grew. This was comedy after their own hearts. I focus ye telescope on ye plate like so. Yes, I can see it, wallowing in the shallows of the custard swamp, the smallest specimen of prune known to science. And this is what happens next. Jennings, what are you doing with that telescope at the luncheon table? I was just looking at my prune through it, sir. And may one inquire the reason for this extraordinary behavior? What could he say? It was impossible to explain out loud to a hushed room a joke that was no longer funny, especially when faced with a master's disapproval. So how is this author thinking like a middle scholar? How is he viewing the world through his eyes?
Adventure and imagination.
Yeah.
Discovery.
Mm-hmm.
Hunting for
investigating.
Grandiosity.
Yes, yes.
It often doesn't come inside the package of adults' expectations very well.
I was hoping someone would think of that. Yes. He shows the joy of his joke and how much his friends were enjoying it, and then how this grown-up just comes along and blasts it to pieces. And shows that he just deflates it to this ridiculous size and shows how what seems so clever to a 10-year-old is just stupid to an adult. And Anthony Bucharidge does really well with this. His books, you just feel like a 10-year-old again when you read them. So how can we get inside middle scholars' skins? What are your suggestions? What can we do?
Show an injustice and then resolve it.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. That's a good idea. Show injustices and then resolve them.
Just observation can happen.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
Teach something that is beyond their vision,
uh-huh.
like through microscopes and things of that sort. And about a little bit about chemicals and things, mm-hmm. and different things.
Mm-hmm. Interact with them. Yes. Good.
Remember what you're like in the middle.
Yeah.
And remember how big the problems that look small to us look to children.
That's right. Exactly. Good. Here's some of the ones I have. Spend time with them and listen to them talk. If you're going to be writing for them, you want to write in their language. Find out what's important to them. And do some remembering. And I have one suggestion for doing some remembering. Go read your diaries if you kept one. I just did that before this. I've sure forgotten what I was like back then. It was almost embarrassing. And this mother I was talking to last Friday said she pitched hers. She was so embarrassed about what kind of a girl she was that she just didn't want anybody else to find out what she had written. So she pitched hers. Yep, that's that one. And also, quite a few middle scholar authors that I researched said how helpful it was to get real, live 9 to 14-year-olds to read and critique their work. Now, they have a little bit of trouble analyzing things, but if you can get them on a roll, sometimes you can, or even ask them very pointed questions, they can give you a surprising amount of help. Some writers even co-authored books with a middle scholar. One mom and her daughter did it together. She said how helpful that was. Okay, let's explore some more how the authors of Middle Scholar Classics wrote to Middle Scholar's Heartbeats. They were very true to the truth of the emotional makeup of a middle scholar. They have portrayed middle scholars' emotions as intensely as they feel them. Do you remember how keenly you felt everything when you were this age? How much of a big deal everything was? And now you look back and wonder, why was it so important to me that Mom put pickled limes in my lunch? And I didn't even really like them, but everybody else thought they were great, so I had to have them too. And if she said, no, you don't want those, you thought, oh, she must not really love me. She doesn't let me pack them. And then, I don't know if you think this, but thought this, but maybe I'm just an orphan she took in, that sort of thing. Yeah, it's funny now, but it was your life. That was really how you felt back then. And so a good middle scholar's author will embody this emotional truth. So let's take a look at how Mrs. Taylor captured this in Henrietta, her character from All of a Kind Family. Let me read you a little background to the story snippet that I'm going to put up in just a minute. Henny was sick of sitting up straight while Miss Corbett, her geography teacher, went on and on about geography. It was hot and she was so bored. All of a sudden, a shrill little squeak piped out from somewhere back in her throat. Miss Corbett stopped talking. Teacher, there must be a mouse in the room, yelled Fanny. Well, they eventually discovered the mouse had a dress on. And Miss Corbett told Henny, all right, write the words, I'll never make noises in class again, 100 times on the blackboard. So Henny wrote and wrote and wrote. And all the time, the anger inside her bubbled and boiled. This was just too much. Nobody likes me, she said to herself. Nobody ever does anything nice for me. Even at home, there's nothing but scoldings and punishments, sometimes even spankings. I'm going to run away to some place where they'll never find me. That will make them all good and sorry. And she did run away for one evening. And if you're a middle scholar, this decision of Henny's makes emotional sense to you, even though you know it's the wrong decision. Middle scholars are all dealing with those crucial and vital issues in their lives, and the intensity of their own experiences draws them right into Henny's, and it just makes sense to them. So again, even though we as adults know it's not that big of a deal, we still have to capture those feelings and emotions. And we don't want to, at least my students pick up really fast if you don't identify with it. And so this is something that's fairly important if you want to capture their hearts. Do you have any experiences you want to share about this or ideas about how to do this?
I think it helps if you have a particular child in mind while you're writing and you think of how that child would say things,
yes,
and how, what reactions they would make,
yeah,
to certain incidents.
Because I don't know if every single child would think things like this, probably the more intense ones. But yet I was surprised in the ones I talked to, even like the moms I asked about if their children think this way. How many of them said, oh, yes, this is normal. Even one that's very quiet, and I would have had no idea that he would have gotten to this point sometimes. He does.
I think the more outgoing ones tend to emote like that verbally, but the ones that are shyer are thinking that way inside their head. So they might identify with it even though they're not exhibiting that kind of behavior exactly. Yeah. They're still ruminating and that's what's going on inside their heads, so they can still identify with it.
Yeah. I think you're right.
Is there a difference between boys and girls?
There is. In fact, this mother I was talking to, she said, are you going to bring that in? Because I've been reading this book called, see if I can remember what it is. Something about a big deal. And it's The Difference Between Boys and Girls. It's a completely secular author, but she's just so fascinated with the very distinct differences. One of them, she said, that the difference is that the girls, when you're trying to help them with this sort of thing, they want to be understood. They want you to say, yes, I know how it feels, and yes, this is important to you. They need that sympathy. She said the boys, they are just always vying for being on top. Like, yeah, that's their, they don't want things to be equal. They don't want that understanding necessarily. But I haven't researched it enough myself to know how that all would apply to writing.
I'm wondering if girls emote more with verbal, that kind of thing, and boys maybe act out the emotions a little more, often with some kind of physical aggression or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Do you all agree? Is that what you did?
Competitiveness.
Competitive? Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's just the same kind.
No, it's not. But I think it's beginning here. Like, think 6-7-year-olds, they do, there's some this way, but it's becoming a lot more intense.
I had twin sons. My wife had twin sons. And at 12, 14 is when it became very evident that you do a thing, basically.
Yeah.
When Laura and Mary was always so good, and Laura always couldn't be, and I think that kind of kills the child too, is the idea that's so good.
Yeah, dealing with the inequality of life and what seems so unfair.
Mm-hmm. One difference between boys and girls is that boys, emotionally, psychologically, are developing a little bit behind girls. Mm-hmm. And so a middle scholar girl is at a different emotional maturity than a middle scholar boy. And that's one thing that good books handle well.
Yeah.
Boys and girls notice that they don't think on the same wavelength in this stage of life.
Yes, that's really good.
Another thing about emotional makeup of a middle scholar is the middle scholar is the forgotten age.
Mm-hmm.
Toddlers, small people, have so much energy and attention. And it's nice when they're 10 and you can forget them.
Yes.
And then now they're teenagers and we have to focus on them again.
Exactly.
And so those middle people get overlooked. And if you can, they feel that. They feel overlooked.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and in my research I discovered that. There was this mother who had gone to the library because her 9-year-old had just told her to get out of her life. And she was trying to find something about this age group. She found, terrible twos, sending them to school, and then there was this gap. It jumped straight into adolescence, and So I think you're right. I think it's just something that we feel like they're on the way now, and they're not adolescent yet, so we're okay. But when in reality, as we saw on that list, there's a lot of things happening. And Gary Ezzo, in his book On Becoming Preteen Wise, says that a lot of people don't realize that this is the prime time to build relationships, because the foundation you can lay in this time in their life is going to really help you then when they're adolescents. Good.
You mentioned also, Angela, that they they flop back and forth between being a child and being this other. And they notice that about themselves and it confuses them.
Yeah.
So they feel big and then they feel very small. And then they want to be invisible and then they want to be seen. And
yes, super confusing. Great. This is good. Now we can all go home and capture.
You were talking about ways to identify with the intensity of this age group students. One thing I have noticed is in my daughters, they all like enjoy writing or trying to write. And I will pick up things in their stories that I had never thought to think about. They'll yes. have a character their own age.
Yeah.
And they'll be relating, right, like you had it here. To yeah. any situation.
Yes.
They'll have, the intensity will be there that I never thought of it. I'll often recognize what they're writing about as a situation that had just occurred.
Uh-huh.
And I'll see the intensity there that they felt that I never thought about.
Yes. Then you should co-author with them.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's another thing I picked up. Middle scholar authors teach by influence and not by sermonizing. Do you remember how we agreed in our discussion that influence is beginning to make a bigger impression on a middle scholar than commands, and he's beginning to care about reasons behind commands? So these books don't normally portray an authority figure saying to the main character, you have a problem, you're lazy, you procrastinate, and here's how we're going to cure you. So read this Bible verse and apologize. But even though most of these books we've been talking about don't deal with it in that way, that doesn't mean they don't teach lessons. Here's what happened to Henny when she finally decided to come home after her runaway. Without a word, Mama laid out the remains of supper, and Henny fell to. By the way, Ma, she said between huge mouthfuls, I think the principal wants to see you tomorrow. She gave me an invitation. Henny pulled the crumpled envelope out of her pinafore and handed it to Mama. That night, Mama and Henny had a long, long talk. So how does Sydney Taylor create this scene that shows clearly what's right and wrong without sermonizing?
She just tells what happened.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to say what all Mama said in the talk because everybody can guess that.
Yes, exactly. Mom didn't say a word. And he handed over the principal's note, and they had a long talk. My students just love this part of the story. They had a grand time philosophizing about what Mom told Henny and what Henny had to do later and to make it right and what the principal said when she went in to visit her, and they just thought it was great to make all these judgment calls themselves. But I could tell they were secure in the clear context that Henny did wrong, even though Mrs. Taylor never really comes out and says so.
One thing I see happening there is that Henny's, it was starting to bother Henny's conscience, this invitation to the principal that she had in the problem.
Yes, exactly.
And so she did something about it. But she's not cringing and cowering and whatever. She just came to the realization that this is what she needs to do.
Yes, exactly.
The mother lets the daughter initiate bringing up the subject.
Uh-huh.
She's meeting her physical needs and just giving her time to.
Yes.
I see there's a trust there between Henny and her mama. And Henny wants that. She wants her mama to know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Even though she didn't at first.
Mm-hmm. The fact that she came back home. It's acknowledgement that she did wrong. I mean, if it wasn't wrong to run away, she wouldn't go out. She'd go back home.
Yeah. And she tried to cover it up. She came swaggering in the door and said, hello, everyone, when they were all gathered there so worried and sweating about what they needed to do next. And where were you? Her papa said, oh, just around. And she was trying to show she didn't care. But as you can see, she had reached a resolution of what she was going to do to fix this.
And we could wonder why she had a problem with him.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I heard once was that children this age, and even teenagers too, but that's not what we're talking about now, even though they're masters of drama themselves, make no allowance for drama in
exactly.
the authority figures.
Yes.
And that has helped me a lot as a mom, and just to think about what sets them off. I mean, they might be bringing a lot of drama to the table, but you are not allowed to bring any. And so I think that's something to consider, yes, as you're writing.
Exactly. And you can see how well she captured this.
Right.
The mom just stayed low-key. She just gave her supper. And then Henny was ready for a long, long talk.
And that's why you like it, because that's just perfect.
Yes.
That's what you want out of the mom.
Yes. Anything else on your mind about this before we go to the next point? Okay, here's another technique you probably picked up from our story samples already. Middle scholars love to laugh. So tell me, what's one of their favorite conversation pieces when they're together?
Jokes.
Yes, knock-knock jokes, puns, funny riddles. My particular group of students this year are just charmed by these. I've heard so many in the last 8 months, I think I could write a series. So the percentage of books that are funny that the students selected in my survey didn't surprise me. 90%. Think Grandma's Attic? Let's just take a quick look at how Mr. Bucharidge, the Jennings man, wove in humor in unexpected places. I noticed you had a flat tire, Mr. Wilkins said. Well, it's only flat on the bottom, of course, but it will have to be changed all the same. Is this your car, Jack? Of course this is my car, but how did you know my name was Jack? I didn't. I merely said, oh, but you did. I heard you. Gently, Mr. Wilkins explained, I only knew your family name was Carr. Yes, that's right, Jack Carr. A ripple of chuckles showed that Mr. Carr was beginning to savor the joke to the full. Jack Carr's carjack. I must remember that. And my children just laughed and laughed and laughed over that part. They thought it was great, and they quoted it for weeks. So, any thoughts or input on this one? Because we don't exactly want to write comedies, but we want to weave in humor.
You can do it in a way that doesn't say, here's a joke, now laugh.
Yes.
But if it can be there where maybe not every reader is going to pick it up, mm-hmm, but once in a while, a reader will say, "That's punny," and they will laugh. That this age group enjoys discovering humor.
Yes, I've noticed they just love when they find the joke out themselves. Mm-hmm.
Well, the language is simple. It's not broad, big vocabulary words. When everybody knows what a car and a jacket, I think we need to be careful not to use too big words, and they might miss the idea.
And, like, the tire being only flat on the bottom. The students had never thought of that before. But, yes, every time there's anything about tires that came up, any time, they would talk about how tires are only flat on the bottom, you know. So it's not anything profound.
Mm-hmm. It also doesn't come at anyone's expense where it makes them, yes, feel dumb or stupid. Mm-hmm. It's the fun humor that isn't hurting anybody.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's not exactly foolish or silly, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just plain fun.
Yeah. And this didn't really happen. This is all fiction, but still, it's believable. Mm-hmm. Okay, good.
Is humor maybe a good way to diffuse some of that intensity of emotion?
I wonder. I thought of that when I was getting ready for this. And even just watching, especially my fourth graders, they're just constantly saying these jokes. And I wondered sometimes if it wasn't just to, you know, subconsciously, I'm sure they're not thinking this, but just to lighten up their life a little.
Mm-hmm. Either laugh or cry.
Yeah, there you go.
One thing I wonder from my experience when I was young, also with the humor, if not always making like a joke, but kind of there was a series I liked and it had the serious parts, but also watching the antics of the boys and the story.
Yeah.
It had its humorous parts, so I'd get a good laugh. And
yeah.
The mix, mm-hmm. I think, was a good thing.
Yeah. And this comes from the same book where poor Jennings had to skip, I forget how many meals, because he was looking at his prune through the telescope. So he had a really hard life in some ways. But, yeah, I can see what you're saying. He lightens up. And this is actually in direct connection to something that happened to Jennings. He had stuck his head through a fence, a cast iron fence, to take a picture of a squirrel on the other side. And he got stuck. Like, he tried to come back out, and his ears stuck out, and he couldn't get back through. So Mr. Wilkins is on a hunt to find a carjack to pry the fence open to get his head out. So it's right in the middle of a very emotion-filled experience. So, yeah, that's good. Okay. Remember how middle scholars are hungry for adventure? Well, one strong technique in capturing adventure stories are that they're kept moving. When I was reading a really detail-rich part in the storybook, we're reading for story right now, it was describing the scenery and, you know, all that sort of stuff. They got frustrated. They kept saying, when are we going to get to the real story? And another one said, I just want to know what's going to happen. Well, so do I, actually. What do you do when you're reading to yourself and you get to this long paragraph that describes the lady's alabaster brow and the man's rim and nose?
Skip.
You might skim quick to see if there's anything significant happening and then go. Poor authors. But good authors, especially for middle scholars, know that they want a strong forward pace. So they know not to include long, windy paragraphs of descriptions in the first place. Let's see how Claire Bishop did this in her piece from the book 20 and 10. And suddenly we were all fighting like cats and dogs. It was a regular free-for-all, the boys pummeling each other and the girls pulling one another's hair. The soft white wings of Sister Gabriel's headdress flapped hurriedly across the yard. There, there, children, she called. Shame on you. No, I don't want to hear a thing. Think of you getting into a fight when I was just coming to tell you. What? We cried eagerly, crowding around her. You will see, in the classroom, quick. Now you shake hands with one another and file in on tiptoe. So how do these paragraphs show strong forward pace?
Didn't spend very much time on the fight.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And they were barely into their fight before she showed up.
And she moved them right along. She didn't stop and say, you should not have been fighting.
They knew that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Very short sentences.
Mm-hmm.
No descriptions?
True enough, yes. But you get a clear picture of what's going on. Mm-hmm.
I don't want to hear a thing. She doesn't spend a whole bunch of time with this argument dialogue.
Mm-hmm. And she's barely correcting them before she's headed into a hint of what's happening next. Mm-hmm. Did you notice her great ability to correct without sermonizing? We talked about that just a little bit. In her very last sentence, you can see she does want them to behave. She cans with one another, and yeah.
If we would write from her perspective, wouldn't we get a completely different story? I'm thinking about if you have a middle scholar try to recount what happened at school today, this is how they'll tell it. It'll just condense. And then she came out and said, no, you can't talk, and we went in. And if you ask the teacher, this is all this detail about it. All the things going on at recess, and so everyone said. And so,
yes, yes.
And so this author is writing from the middle scholar's perspective. This is the way life goes.
Yes, yes. And that is a good thing to keep in mind.
Just that they
went
great advice. Now you shake hands with one another and file them on tiptoe. I think I
gave my own children. Yes. Uh-huh. And if you ever try this, you'll notice how it just the animosity between them just dissolves. That something about having to shake each other's hands just yeah.
Tiptoe means they're not going to be stamping.
That too. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because of middle scholars' growing awareness of the world around them, they're picking up really quickly that life isn't fair, that sad things happen that mom and dad can't control, and that life hurts sometimes, and it hurts a lot. And good middle scholar authors know that it's okay to write about these kinds of things because it's easier to explore ideas in a story than in real life. You can read and process things, you know, like the sales pitch goes, in the comfort of
your own home.
And for middle scholars, it's in the comfort of this book where things are going to stay within these pages and not impact my own life, not rock my whole world. So let's take a look how the authors of the Trailblazer books did this in The Chimney Sweep's Ransom. "Mama," Ned fell to his knees by his mother's chair. "Where's Pip? Did Papa take him?" Louisa Carter took a trembling breath. "Your father met a merchant who recruits children to be chimney sweeps in London." No. In all the fears he had, Ned had never imagined his 7-year-old brother dropping out of his life. And most of our children don't have to worry about their siblings being taken away. But, like I said, they're starting to awake to the reality of these things. And they want to think about them. They want to explore them. And they often ask questions about hard things. But, it's, of course, as you know, too, as adults, it's easier to do that in a story. To think about it, to think through it, talk about someone in a story than about me and the things that are happening in my life. So any thoughts on this one? Are there things that are too dark that we should bring up?
Doesn't it depend on the personality of the child? I mean, we have one who is extremely fearful.
Uh-huh.
Reading about anything like this would cause nightmares.
Yeah.
Or could cause nightmares.
Yeah, I agree.
Mm-hmm. The next one, you know, it'll all go well.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't, they're not all the same.
Yeah. So are you saying that maybe it's important for us to choose subjects that aren't...
Not necessarily. I don't know. As a mother, I don't know quite how to handle it. Because,
yeah.
But phase one will completely uproot the next one. But,
mm-hmm.
You know, in that sense, it almost helps her to work through her fears. By reading something like this, if we maybe talk about it afterwards or something like that,
yeah.
It'll also have fears take root in her mind.
That weren't there before.
That weren't there before.
Hmm.
It can be a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
For most children, I don't think it would be a problem, but for someone with her personality, it can be a challenge.
Yeah.
I can agree with that to a point. We had a school teacher in that middle grade who often for story time she would read like missionary stories or the Indians did stuff to them or murdered them or whatever. And my children, she really, I think it was way more mean to my son. I actually said something to the school teacher then how it seemed to surprise her. I think she did it for our children to realize what other Christians go through. Good educational, but it did scare them. It gave them some fears they normally wouldn't have. So
yeah, maybe
I'm not saying it's all bad. I think some of it's good, but some children are going to react to it differently.
There is an important side to this. Maybe we should talk about that next. It's really important to always have a seed of hope. Mm-hmm. Most middle scholars marked in my survey that I did that they like stories that were dangerous and adventurous, but not a story where someone died. And when I asked some of them about it more later, they were very emphatic. They just hate it when someone dies in their story, especially if it's someone they're journeying with, someone that they've taken into their hearts, like we talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
They just do not like it. Even if someone does die, we were talking about this, it seemed very important to them that they still get a definite sense that the other story people are going to be okay in the end, or that something's going to work out well for them. So let's take a look at what happens in the very next paragraph after Ned discovers the shocking news that his father has sold his little brother to this firm in London. Ned scrambled to his feet and stumbled out the door. He couldn't let this happen. He'd find Pip. They'd run away. He didn't know what he would do, but he knew one thing. He had to find Pip. And if you're reading this story aloud to middle scholars and you stop and ask them at this particular spot, so what do you think? Do you think Ned's going to find his brother? What do they say? Yes, of course. And some of them would say, well, yeah, the title says, the chimney sweeps ransom. Or like I'm reading to them one of the Yvonne books from Myrna Grant, and it's called The Daring Escape, and it's a little scary, and sometimes I'll stop and ask, do you think they're going to get out of this prison? Oh, yeah, because the title says escape. So they're hanging on to that. So I think it's okay to put dark things in your stories, but you do need that seed of hope that they can hang on to.
When I was teaching school, I read the story, The Drunkard's Children, Grunstaff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Grunstaff. And a parent asked me to discontinue it. Their children couldn't handle it.
Uh-huh.
And so I just, you know, stopped it. But, you know, it affected them that much.
Yeah.
They couldn't handle it.
So it's something we have to be careful with, obviously. Mm-hmm.
The one thing that I've been hesitant about is the spiritual darkness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you're right. That's not exactly what I had in mind. I was thinking more of hard things in life that happen or might happen to their friends or, yeah, to themselves too. My group of students this year is particularly susceptible to that right now because one of my second grade boys lost his little brother like 2 weeks before school started. He fell into an irrigation ditch and drowned. And my second grader was the one that found him. And so, yeah. We've been talking a lot about a lot of hard things this school year. So it's real, but yet we do have to handle it well.
I think there's some subjects that you almost need to have an adult there to walk through them with. And if you mm-hmm. if you've got like a story in a story paper that they're just reading on their way home from church or however they do, you might not have any idea that your child is dealing with this thing. Maybe something they never even considered before. I think we need to be a little bit considerate mm-hmm. of that when we're writing stories for children, because some things you almost need your mom or dad to walk with you.
Yeah. So what would you say fits in the category of, because that's not going to always happen, as ideal as it is. So what would fit in a category of, I guess it would depend even how you write it, I was going to say of safe, dark things.
I was just going to say, make sure something good at the very end comes out, like Where the Red Fern Grows. The children
yeah.
love that book. The dogs both die, but that red fern, they just, that's at the end. It's their,
mm-hmm. it's their little seed of hope to hang on to. Mm-hmm.
This isn't middle schoolers, and it's a little different, but I heard an adult recently say that when he reads a story or a novel, a story book, he likes to read the first couple chapters to get the setting, and then he likes to go read the last chapter, and then he can, as he reads through the middle, there's still the suspense of knowing how things are going to work out. But even if it's 11 o'clock at night and this character's in a really bad situation, mm-hmm. he can still lay the book down because he knows in the end it's going to come out right.
Yeah.
I think it helps if the bad thing that's happening in the story is not the fault of the child who's the main character.
Yeah.
My son did not handle a book where the boy was deliberately disobeying his parent and got into a situation where there was a lot of gruesome stuff going on. And somehow knowing that he wasn't supposed to be there, plus
yes.
all these gory details,
yeah,
it was very unsettling too.
Mm-hmm.
I've been reading some really dark stories about the Holocaust and mm-hmm. Or like Anabaptist history and religious history. But you always have these heroes of faith coming
yes.
out, and my children, they just love it. And I'd ask somebody, I said, like, look, if you have nightmares or something, like, tell me. Oh no. And I think it kind of rolls off of them because it's not action for them.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so they hear it, but they feel safe and secure and
mm-hmm.
can go on, and to them it's just heroes to have a real life.
That's their focus, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a good point, that it's not something that is real happening in their own life. Like you're talking about your mm-hmm. second grader losing his brother, and so mm-hmm. if you would read a story where that happened to someone
yeah.
too close to the town
yes.
and it happened to him,
exactly.
that would be more overwhelming to him than if that had not happened to him when he heard
right.
the story.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. There is that sensitivity, but I've known some children who are more fearful, who couldn't handle a particular book. But then when maybe they lost a grandma, they were ready to read a book about a character who did and figure out how did she deal with this. Whereas before it was really, really fearful. Well, now I'm in it and I would like to relate to a girl my same age who's going through it.
Yeah.
So yeah, children are different.
Yeah, they are.
Take that into account.
Mm-hmm. And I can see that because then you want to read about someone who went through this and survived and did well. It gives you
and
hope then.
Maybe you want to cry about it with no one looking either.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Good. This is all good. Okay, we've got 10 minutes for our quiz. What does our writing need to do to capture middle scholars' hearts? Can you finish the main points? View the world through? Yes. Be true to their... Yeah. Influence, don't...
Sermonize.
Yes, good. Weave in...
Humor.
Mm-hmm. Keep a strong...
Pace.
Yes, forward pace. Mm-hmm. It's okay for...
Dark things.
Yes. Things to get dark, but always leave.
A seed of hope.
Yes. And I'm really glad for the input y'all gave on those last 2 points, because I think it probably is pretty conditional on how we do it. Okay. So I'm hoping that we can go forward and work together to improve the landscape of good, wholesome, God-centered middle scholar literature. And I'm going to look forward to seeing all this emerging from the people here. Thank you for listening.
Mm-hmm. We had talked about the different series that mm-hmm. we grew up with, and one of the things I thought about as we were talking about that, and then throughout this talk, many of those were written decades ago.
Yeah.
And in some of them, they have racial comments that were not acceptable. You know, in the Little House books, Ma just hated Indians.
Uh-huh.
And I mentioned the Law of Slensky, how much I like them. But I'm sure if I go back and read them, they would be have comments that would not at all be appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of these other series would be the same way. And so how do we deal with that? There's a lot of... interesting, good reading from years ago, but they do have that woven through.
Mm-hmm. So are you thinking, how can we write stories that don't have these things that will date them? Or
well,
not so much
what
that?
About just handing them over to our children to read.
Oh.
That's what I was thinking about.
Uh-huh.
We have these good feelings, and so we go to, you know, library sales, and we're pulling off Little House books, and Carolyn Hayward. I just love Carolyn Hayward. You know, but they were all written in a much different era.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we do that in dealing with giving our children reading material?
Yeah.
I just gave one of my girls a book to read. I don't know if I gave it to her. She probably took it, but it definitely had some white supremacy stuff in it. And I just talked to her about it. I said, it's a very interesting book, but you need to be aware that this is what's happening. I mean, that's the attitude they have, and it's not right.
Yeah.
I they're old enough to talk to. Just tell them what to look out for and the things that are inaccurate in the book. Honors their powers of reason, I think.
Yeah.
And also makes them aware that they need to use them. If you just bring the subject up, you can just tell them to look out for those
mm-hmm.
kinds of things.
Yeah.
Well, some of those Holocaust stories, the people laugh to save other people's lives. Mm-hmm. And I ran into that when I would read that to my students, and I would just tell them that, you know, here the mother straight out lied And the children knew it, and you know, they had to figure out how to deal with it. We know that that's not right, but that's what she did here, and now you can see what the consequences are, whatever.
Yeah.
I think there's a good place for that. I noticed with our 8-year-old, text before reading the story or before giving the book, saying, there are some things that X character does that Daddy does not like. Why don't you see if you can find them and tell me about them? And she takes that better than if you say, rah, rah, rah,
yeah.
Hey, 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 that thing. But if she comes and says, oh, this, she said that about this black girl in there, and that was not kind. Okay. She's taking it on her own, and I think it goes a lot better.
Yeah, I agree.
Some of these books that were written decades ago were maybe part of the kind of thing that spurred the vision for Christian Life. And so if we can learn from them how to write good stories that children like just as well, that's a...
Yeah.
I'd just like to say that the partners, keepers, could use good writers.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody here would like to write for partners,
yes.
Go ahead and do it.
And that was part of my vision for this. I was just really hoping I could get a whole crowd of people excited about this great age. Especially I'm excited about how much potential they have for taking someone in their hearts, and you just have this whole... group of readership that you can write and write for, and they would never get tired of you sending in your stories. Good. Well, anything else on your minds, or are you ready to go?
I did have a question. Mm-hmm. We talked about books that go into too much detail get boring. Am I the only one that doesn't like Little House series for that reason? When as a child, I don't. I know everybody. I mean, a lot of people seem to enjoy this. My face just—they just drove me crazy. Explain how they did this, and it explained how they did that. The difference between male and female, I don't know, but I just didn't like not the first ones. As Mary and Laura grew up and got older and were involved with their friends at school and things like that, I enjoyed those more. But the very first, the Little House in the Big Woods, and those.
Yeah. Well, I read some of them. I tried to read a lot before I had this, and I read some of them, and I had forgotten how detail-rich they were. So, but I don't remember. I remember subconsciously thinking it, but I didn't, yeah. But I remember I skipped a lot just to go to where the things were really happening.
I did that too, even already as a child, because there was nothing happening. I didn't think.
Yeah.
My question is, does Ned find Pip?
Yes, he does. And it's historical fiction, and it takes John Wesley to help him find.
My students love these books. I've read a whole bunch of them, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They went through a lot of hard things before they got there, and you just kept wondering if it was ever going to happen, but yeah.